Use math to make the world a better place. Become an actuary through the Society of Actuaries and find solutions to the world's most pressing challenges. As an actuary, the only thing higher than the pay is the satisfaction.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast.
I don't know if you've felt this lately, but the whole country feels weirdly fragile. Like everything still technically works until you lean on it. And that's what got me, because there's a theory, a real one, that says every few generations, America enters a season where the old order starts to fail. Not all at once. And that's the part that gets you. It happens slowly at first. Trust gets thinner. Money starts feeling strange. Families split over things they used to survive just fine. Institutions still stand there, but they feel older somehow, like heavier. Like they're running on reputation more than strength. And then one day you look around and realize it's not just one problem, it's everything. And that's what makes this so hard to explain. Because it doesn't feel like a single crisis. It feels like the whole country is carrying too much weight in too many places, all at the same time. The headlines feel louder. The people feel meaner. The center feels like it's gone. And maybe that sounds dramatic. I thought so too initially. Except until I found the pattern. Because according to this theory, this feeling, this exact pressure, shows up in cycles. Roughly every 80 years, the same kind of stress starts building. The rules just stop making sense. People stop trusting the referees. The country starts pulling itself apart. And eventually, whether through war, collapse, or some kind of brutal reset, the old system breaks. Now, if that sounds like internet doom porn with better branding, I get it, I totally do. But then I started lining up the years, the 1770s, 1860s, 1930s. And that's when this stopped feeling like a theory. Because if the pattern is even close to real, then this isn't the calm before the storm. It's the part of the cycle where the storm has already started, and most people still think it's weather. This is Divergent Files. So I did what I probably should have done first. I stopped staring at the headlines, and I backed up, like way up. Because when you're trapped inside the daily noise, everything feels random. But the second you pull back, even a little, something starts to line up. So go back to the 1770s for a second, before the war, before the country had a name, before anybody was painting George Washington like he walked around glowing. And just sit in that moment for a minute. The colonies are still under British rule. The laws are still on the books. The system still exists. From the outside, it probably even looks stable enough. But underneath all of that, the strain is building. More and more people stop believing the arrangement is fair. The old rules are still there, yes, but they don't feel legitimate anymore. And once that happens, once enough people stop believing the system deserves obedience, the machine can still function on paper, but in real life, well, it's already starting to fail. That pressure builds until the whole thing finally breaks. And then what do you get? Revolution. Now, move forward. Not a few years, but a full lifetime. Roughly 80 years. You land in the 1860s. And this is where it started bothering me. Because the details are different, obviously. The clothes change, the language changes, the argument changes. But the pressure underneath it? that part starts to feel weirdly familiar. On the surface, everything still looks intact. The country is still there. The flag is still there. The institutions are still standing. But by that point, what's breaking isn't the appearance of order, it's the belief in it. And when a country gets there, when enough people stop believing the same system can hold them together, the fight stops being political. It becomes existential. And that's the Civil War. Now you move forward again, another 70, maybe 80 years. Now you're standing in the 1930s. And again, the same shape starts to show itself. The banks are collapsing. Families are getting wiped out. Confidence is evaporating. The economy doesn't just wobble, it buckles. But what makes that era feel eerie isn't just the suffering. It's the deeper feeling underneath it. That sense that the old rules aren't protecting people anymore. That the institutions everyone trusted maybe aren't as solid as they looked. And once that kind of faith cracks, history tends to get violent. It doesn't stay in the markets. It spills. So first you get the Depression, then a world war. And by the time that whole cycle burns through, the country doesn't just recover. It comes out the other side looking stronger than ever, but also quite different. Power is more centralized. The government is way bigger. The country is more confident, more coordinated, and maybe a little too sure it finally got the formula right. And then you move forward again, roughly 80 more years, and now it's us. That's the moment this stopped feeling like history trivia to me. Because once is a story, twice is strange, but three times, spread across nearly 2.5 centuries, with roughly the same spacing between them, well, that starts to feel less like coincidence and more like a clock. And look, I'm not saying history repeats like some cheap prophecy. It doesn't. The events are different. The people are different. But the deeper pattern, the pressure, the fracture, the reset, that part starts to look uncomfortably familiar. And now we're in the 2020s. So if that spacing is real, if this rhythm is real, then the question isn't whether America feels unstable. The question is whether we've entered the next breaking season already, and whether the thing we're calling chaos is actually the beginning of another reset. So let's dig a little deeper and let's go back to the 1770s. Not as a history class, just as a feeling. British rule is still in place. The crown still has authority. The laws still exist. The governors are still in office. If you're looking from a distance, the system still seems intact. But that's what makes this important, because systems don't usually die the moment they get weak. They die when enough people stop believing they're legitimate. And that's what starts happening here. People weren't just frustrated. They were starting to feel like the people making the rules had no real claim to make them. That the laws were coming from too far away, landing too hard, and asking obedience from people who no longer believed the arrangement was fair. Once that shift happens, everything changes. The argument is no longer, how do we fix this? It becomes, why are we still accepting this at all? And after that, every new act from London just makes the break more likely. The Stamp Act in 1765, the Townshend Acts in 1767, the Boston Massacre in 1770, the Tea Act in 1773, the Coercive Acts of 1774. That's not just a list of events, that's pressure building in public. Each move convinces more people the system isn't correcting itself, it's tightening. And once enough people believe reform is off the table, well, rebellion stops sounding reckless. It starts sounding rational. And that's the pattern. By the time the revolution turns violent, the British system hasn't failed because it disappeared. It failed because, in the minds of the people living under it, it no longer deserved to even exist. The institutions were still standing, but the belief that held them up was already gone. And once that breaks, well, history tends to move fast. Now, If that was just the violent birth of a country, fine, we could call it unique. But then the same pressure shows up again. And this time, it's inside the country itself. Now move forward, less than a century, and this is where it stops feeling like a pattern and starts feeling like a warning. Because by the time you step into the 1850s, America is still technically one country. Same constitution, same flag, same capital, same story people keep telling about themselves. But if you actually stand in that moment for a second, it already feels split. Not politically, not just that. I'm talking about deeper than that. It feels like two different nations pretending to share one address. And that, well, that's where this gets ugly. Because slavery is the moral center of it. It has to be said that way. But it's not only slavery. It's money. It's land. It's expansion. It's industry. It's who gets power as the country grows west. It's who gets to define what America even is. That's the part people flatten. They act like this was just one issue, but it wasn't one issue. It was one issue wrapped around five others until the whole thing became impossible to separate. And once moral conflict and economic conflict locked together, well, compromise starts dying fast. At first, the country still tries to manage it. The Missouri Compromise in 1820 buys some time. The Compromise of 1850 buys a little more. Then the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854 basically rips the bandage off and pours gasoline on the wound. And by the time Dred Scott hits 1857, that should have calmed things down, at least in theory. A Supreme Court ruling, final word, case closed. Except it does the opposite, which is not a small detail. That's one of those moments where the system shows you it still has power, but no longer has authority. And those are not the same thing. The court still exists. Congress still exists. Newspapers are screaming at each other every morning. The machinery is all still there. But the center? Well, the center is dying. Because once people stop believing the same institutions can hold the same country together, the argument changes. It's not, how do we fix this anymore? It becomes something colder. It becomes, why are we still pretending this even works? And when a nation crosses that line, it doesn't just split over policy. It splits over reality. People stop seeing the other side as wrong. They start seeing the other side as illegitimate or evil even, maybe as dangerous, as a threat that has to be contained before it destroys their version of the country. And that part matters more than the speeches and the uniforms and all the stuff people remember from the paintings. By the time Lincoln is elected in 1860, seven southern states don't wait. They just leave. That's not normal political conflict. That's millions of people deciding the same government no longer has the right to govern them at all. And once that happens, well, war isn't some shocking accident. It's the last thing left. And that is the Civil War. So now we've seen it twice. First in the 1770s, when people stopped believing the old order deserved obedience. Then we saw it again in the 1860s, when Americans stopped believing they were still living in the same country. And I gotta be honest, that's where this stopped feeling like history to me. Because one national break? Fine, maybe. Maybe that's birth pain. But two, less than a century apart? Well, that starts becoming odd. And once we hit the third one? Well, that's when coincidence starts looking over its shoulder. Now let's move forward again, another lifetime. And this is where the pattern gets hard to shrug off. Because by the time you land in the early 1930s, America still has all the same symbols. The government is still there. Banks still have names on the doors. Markets still open. So from the outside, the machine looks just fine. It looks like a machine. But then the bottom falls out. And not in some abstract Wall Street rich guy sweating way. I mean in the kind of way people feel at the kitchen table. The banks fail. Savings vanish. Jobs disappear. Businesses fold. Families who thought they were stable suddenly find themselves one bad month away from losing everything. By 1933, unemployment is around 25%. That's roughly one in four workers. And that's not just the bad economy. That's the moment ordinary people start looking at the whole system and wondering if anybody is actually in control. And once that doubt spreads, the damage doesn't stay financial. That's the part that kept bothering me. Because when people stop trusting the machine, they don't just lose confidence in banks. They start losing confidence in everything attached to the banks. Government, leadership, the future. The whole story they were told about how this thing works. And for a minute, I thought, well, maybe this was where the pattern broke. Maybe this was one just economic. Just a brutal collapse. Just a financial disaster with no deeper national rupture. But then you keep moving, and it gets worse. Because the pressure doesn't stay in the markets. It spills into politics, into fear, into extremism, into the kind of desperation that makes hard solutions, well, sound reasonable. And once that pressure starts spreading across the world in the 1930s, the whole thing tips. You get World War II. Because now it's not just a depression. It's the same shape again. A break so deep, the old order can't just patch itself and move on. It has to be replaced. And after 1945, well, that's exactly what happens. America doesn't just recover. It comes out the other side with a bigger federal government, a permanent military posture, and a dollar-centered global order. Oh, and an entirely new version of itself. Bretton Woods, NATO, the post-war boom, the suburbs, the highways, the middle class, the whole post-war American world people still talk about like it just happened naturally. But guess what? It didn't. It was built out of a crisis so violent, it remade the system. And now, step back. So that's three national breaks. Three times the country comes out the other side under a completely different operating system. At that point, the question isn't whether America has crises. Obviously, it does. The question is why the biggest ones seem to arrive in roughly the same rhythm, and why each one ends by replacing the world that came before it. Three national breaks, roughly the same distance apart. So, who was crazy enough to try to map it? So now you're staring at it. 1770s, 1860s, 1930s, and 40s. Three major breaks, roughly the same distance apart. So the obvious question becomes, who was crazy enough to look at that and say, no, I think that's a pattern? Well, turns out it wasn't some prophet. It was two writers, William Strauss and Neil Howe. And when I first found that, I'll be honest, I expected this to get goofy pretty fast. Because usually when somebody says they've discovered the hidden rhythm of history, that's your cue to back slowly toward the exit. But this didn't start that way. In 1991, Strauss and Howe published a book called Generations. They looked at American history and argued that generations don't just age, they move in sequence. One generation reacts to the world it inherited. The next reacts to that. Then the next reacts to that. And over enough time, those reactions start creating a social rhythm. Not a prophecy, a rhythm. That distinction matters. Because they weren't saying on this date, this exact event will happen. They were saying society seemed to move through recurring moods. A period of order, then rebellion against that order, then fragmentation, then crisis, and then rebuild. When I first read that, I thought, okay, cute, a little neat, maybe a little too neat. Because humans love turning messy history into clean patterns after the fact. But then it kept going. And that's where it stopped feeling like a clever framework and started feeling a little more dangerous. Because in 1997, they published The Fourth Turning. That's the book people actually remember. That's the one that took the generational idea and sharpened it into a much darker claim. Their argument was this: a long human life, roughly 80 to 100 years, contains four recurring social eras. They called them churnings, not because history repeats exactly, because the mood changes in a recognizable order. First comes a high. That's the stable period after a major crisis. Institutions are strong. Confidence is high. People believe the system works, or at least they want to. Then comes an awakening. People start pushing back. The culture gets restless. The institutions that once felt solid start feeling a bit stale. Conformity starts looking suspicious. Then comes an unraveling, and this one should sound, well, uncomfortably familiar. Trust drops. The center weakens. People stop agreeing on what's even real. The culture gets sharper, meaner, and more fragmented. Institutions are still standing, but fewer people actually even believe in them. And then the fourth and final churning, the crisis era. The season where the old order can't keep carrying the pressure anymore. Now, that doesn't mean the same event every time, and that's important. They were not saying every 80 years, press button, start a war. They were saying the deeper structure breaks, financially, socially, politically, and yes, sometimes militarily, sometimes all at once if history is feeling especially cruel. And once that crisis peaks, well, then the country gets reorganized. So that's the part that's stuck in my throat, because if you strip away the labels, that's exactly what we just walked through. So now the theory isn't just interesting. Now it's sitting right on top of the evidence we already saw. And here's the part that made this go from obscure history framework to something much bigger. Strauss and Howell didn't just describe old cycles. They argued that the next fourth turning would begin sometime in the mid-2000s and intensify into the 2020s. So listen to that again. They wrote that in 1997. Years before, you had the 2008 financial collapse, the social media brain melter, the trust collapse, the pandemic shock. Years before, the country started feeling like one giant family dinner where somebody just brought up politics and nobody's leaving alive. Now, does that mean they predicted everything? No, of course not. And we need to be adults about that. Because if you're vague enough, history can make almost anybody look smart after the fact. But this wasn't that vague. That's what bothered me. They weren't naming exact headlines, no. They were naming the kind of era. And once you realize they said that before we got here, the question changes. It's no longer did they predict the future. Instead, it becomes how close were they and what did they think happens next?
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.
So now bring it back here. Bring it to right now. Because this is where the theory either starts feeling uncomfortably real or falls apart completely. And the truth is, this part got under my skin pretty fast. Because it's not one event. It's the way everything feels like it's fraying at the same time. That's what matters. The texture of it. The feeling that too many systems are under strain at once and nobody really trusts the repair crew. Because if Strauss and Howell were even partly right, then a fourth turning wouldn't just look like one dramatic event. It would feel like a long season where the center stops holding. And if we're being honest, well, that part sounds awfully familiar. I mean, look around. Trust in government has been sliding for years. Trust in media is a joke. Trust in public health, schools, banks, Congress, law enforcement, courts, universities. Even basic shared facts, all of it feels thinner than it used to. And no, that doesn't mean every institution is fake. That's not the point. The point is that more and more people feel like the referees are compromised. And that's totally different. Once people stop believing in the referees, the whole thing gets ugly real fast. Because now the left thinks the courts are captured. The right thinks elections are suspect. Half the country thinks the media is propaganda. The other half thinks the media is too soft. One side sees censorship everywhere. The other sees extremism everywhere. And both sides are fully convinced the other one is either brainwashed, evil, or just totally insane. That's not a healthy disagreement. That's a country starting to lose the middle ground. And this is where I had to stop myself. Because it's easy to turn this into a political ink blot test where everybody sees their favorite villain and calls it insight. That's useless. This pattern only matters if it shows up across systems, not just politics. But right now, it does. You can feel it in the money. Household debt keeps climbing. Credit card balances hit record highs. Housing feels insane. Rent feels insane. Groceries feel insane. Medical bills feel like a prank written by a demon in a necktie. People can be employed responsibly, doing everything right, and still feel like one surprise expense away from getting folded in half. You can feel it in the social fabric. People are more connected than ever, and somehow lonelier than ever. More plugged in, but less grounded. Everyone's more informed, allegedly, and somehow less certain what's even true. You can feel it in the institutions. Congress freezes. Agencies fight. Courts get treated like team mascots. Universities look ideological. News outlets feel tribal. Social media takes every existing fracture and jams a screwdriver into it because outrage scales better than truth. And then there's the weirdest part. Even when the economy is technically fine on paper, a lot of people just don't believe it. And that mattered more than I expected. Because if the official numbers say one thing, but daily life says something else, well, then people stop trusting the numbers too. And once that happens, then you're not just dealing with inflation or debt or media bias or even polarization. You're dealing with something much deeper. You're dealing with a legitimacy problem. Not ordinary anger, something much heavier than that. The sense that systems still exist, but fewer people believe they're actually working for them. And if that sounds familiar, well, it should. Because it's the same emotional weather we just walked through in the 1770s, 1860s, and 1930s. The causes, symbols, and enemies change, yes, but the pressure feels eerily familiar. That's what makes this theory hard to laugh off. Not because it predicts some exact apocalypse state, because it recognizes the social weather. In the weather right now, it feels completely wrong. Like the country is still standing, but everybody's walking around listening for the first crack. But there's a problem, a big one, because patterns are powerful, even when they're wrong. So this is the question that starts eating at you once the pattern clicks. If this really is a fourth turning, then what does that actually mean for our current times? Not in vague internet forum language. I mean in plain English. What is this theory saying comes next? And the answer is not comforting. Because Strauss and Howe were never really saying, here's the exact event. They weren't predicting one specific war, one specific crash, one specific revolution, or even one specific leader riding in on a horse to save the republic or burn it down. It's not that neat. What they were saying is more structural than that, and more dangerous, honestly. They were saying that in a real crisis era, the old order stops being able to absorb pressure. That's the core of it. The institutions don't just get criticized, they stop holding. The political system stops working like normal politics. The economy stops feeling stable. Social trust keeps dropping. The country loses the ability to solve its biggest problems inside the old framework. And once that happens, the pressure has to go somewhere. That's the part people hear and immediately jump to doomsday fantasies. So let's slow that down. A fourth turning does not mean the same ending every time. it means the same kind of ending, a rupture, a moment where the country can't just patch the cracks and move on, because the cracks are the structure now. And if you look back at the three crisis eras we just walked through, that's exactly what happened. That's what the theory says crisis eras are for. They're for reorganization. And that's where this gets uncomfortable again. Because if the model has any value at all, then the instability we feel now might not be the climax. It might just be the setup. The long, ugly stretch where trust falls apart, debt piles up, institutions freeze, people radicalize, and the country drifts towards some kind of forcing event big enough to settle the argument one way or another. And they're not necessarily saying peacefully, just decisively. It could take different forms, a financial reckoning, a constitutional rupture, maybe a major internal emergency, or a war abroad that reshapes power at home. A political realignment so hard, it changes what the government is allowed to do and what the public is willing to accept. Maybe some combination of all those. The theory doesn't tell you the costume. It tells you that the pressure is building toward a scene change. And once I understood that, then everything else started looking different to me. Now, does that mean this theory is true? No, it does not. Not yet. But if you want to understand why serious people got obsessed with this model, this is why. So now, we need to pressure test this theory really hard. Because if the pattern is flawed, we need to know that before people start treating it like destiny. But if it's even half right, that may be even more dangerous. Now, before we all go build bunkers and start naming our children after Roman emperors, we need to slow down. Because this is the moment where a useful pattern can turn into a bad religion. And that matters, like, a lot. Because once a theory starts feeling a little too accurate, people stop investigating and start obeying it instead. So I went back and looked at the actual criticism. Not the lazy stuff. I mean the real pushback from historians, sociologists, critics, and honestly, anybody who gets nervous when someone says they found the secret rhythm of civilization. And the first problem hits immediately. The timelines are flexible. Like, too flexible sometimes. Strauss and Howe talk in broad windows, generational spans, mood shifts, which sounds reasonable at first, until you realize that if your timeline can slide a little here, stretch a little there, and absorb a few extra years when reality gets inconvenient, almost any major crisis can start looking like a hit. And that bothered me. Because a model can be insightful and still be slippery. And slippery models are dangerous. Then there's the cherry-picking problem. And this was a big one for me and harder to ignore. Because once you want to see a repeating cycle, history becomes a buffet and your brain turns into a drunk guy with tongs. You grab the revolution, you grab the Civil War, you grab the Depression and World War II. You line them all up, and sure, it looks eerie. But what about the crises that don't fit cleanly in that span? What about Reconstruction? What about the Gilded Age panics? What about 1918? What about the 1960s? Or how about 9/11? Or what about the 2008 collapse? Do those belong inside the cycle too? Do they start a different cycle? Do they intensify one? Or do we just move the goalposts until they behave? You see what I mean? That's the problem. The more flexible the theory gets, the harder it is to falsify. And if a theory can explain everything after the fact, well, sometimes it's not a model. Sometimes it's just elegant storytelling. And to be fair, humans are terrifyingly good at elegant storytelling. Give us a messy century and we will absolutely turn it into a neat little four-act structure, slap a label on it, and act like we cracked the code. But to be clear, that doesn't mean the pattern is fake either. But it does mean our brains are fully capable of hallucinating order when chaos would be a lot less emotionally satisfying. And then there's the generational branding. And this is where it starts sounding a little horoscopy. Once you start saying entire generations share the same social role, the same mood, same archetype, even the same destiny, you're walking right up to the line between useful sociology and historical astrology. Because boomers are this, Gen X are that, millennials are this. Well, that stuff can get real stupid real fast. People are much messier than archetypes. History is messier than neat cycles. And for a minute, I honestly thought that might be the end of it. I thought, well, maybe this whole thing was just a smart-sounding pattern machine. That should have closed the case, but it didn't. Because even after all that, the theory still wouldn't quite die. Even when you hit it with the strongest criticisms, something about it still feels like it's touching a real nerve. Maybe not scientifically, but maybe it's describing something real badly. And if that's true, then the danger isn't just the theory. It's what happens when people with money, power, and microphones start treating that rough map like a weather report. Because even if the cycle is flawed, a lot of very serious people started acting like it wasn't. This is where the whole thing changes. Because up to this point, the fourth tourney can still sit in that safe little category people love. Interesting theory, weird pattern, maybe useful, but maybe nonsense. Fine. But that's not the question that started bothering me. The question that started bothering me was this. Who actually started doing it like it was real? Who actually started using it like it was real? Not quoting it, I mean using it, planning around it. So I went looking for receipts, real ones. And the first name is obvious, Steve Bannon. Not because this is a partisan hit piece, because it's not. And if somebody wants it to be, well, you're already missing the point. Bannon matters because he's one of the clearest public examples of someone with real political influence who didn't just find the fourth turning interesting. He treated it like a working model. In 2010, Bannon released Generation Zero, a documentary built directly around Strauss and Howe's crisis cycle idea. The whole film basically reframes the 2008 financial crash as proof that America had entered the next major turning. And the message at the end is not subtle. Quote, "History is seasonal and winter is coming." That's in the film. That's not me dressing it up. And then there's the part that didn't sit right. Historian David Kaiser, who consulted on the project, later said Bannon expected a new major war as part of the coming crisis and, quote, did not seem at all fazed by the prospect. And that matters, because that's not somebody nervously studying a theory. That's somebody looking at possible breakdown and treating it like weather. And once a person with political ambition starts seeing social fracture that way, their whole relationship to instability changes. They stop asking how to lower the temperature, and instead, they start asking how to move through it or use it. That was the first big receipt, but it wasn't the only one. Because once you leave politics and follow the trail into finance, this thing gets a lot stranger. At first, I figured maybe it would show up in a few interviews, but no. It went much further than that. Neil Howe himself didn't stay tucked away in the world of books and lecture halls. He started showing up in investor circles and financial media. You can find him in places like Real Vision, talking directly to audiences obsessed with debt cycles, institutional fragility, political disorder, and what happens when an old system starts shaking apart. That alone is interesting, but it's still just discussion. Except, then came the harder receipt. The hedge eye, as in Keith McCullough's hedge eye. Because by 2025, hedge eye wasn't just interviewing Hal. They built an actual product around the idea. An actual product. It's called the Hedge Eye Fourth Turning ETF, with the ticker HEFT, Heft. That is not satire or some internet joke. That is a real financial vehicle built around the assumption that this crisis framework can shape investment strategy. HedgeEye called it plainly. They called it the fourth turning portfolio. How to invest through today's chaos. You can't make this up. And in their own language, they described Hal and their portfolio team explaining what the current K chaotic environment means for investors, including which sectors and themes might benefit as the cycle intensifies. That phrase should make you sit up a little, because now we're not talking about a theory that helps people think. We're talking about a theory that helps people allocate capital. And that's very different. And look, to be fair, finance people will turn literally anything into a tradable asset if you can give them 3 data points, a Bloomberg terminal, and a little confidence. That part, sadly, is not new. But this still matters, because it proves the theory didn't stay philosophical. It became operational. And then there's John Malden. He's a mainstream macro voice with a huge institutional readership. And he's been openly writing about Neil Howe for years. In 2023, after covering Howe's updated work, Malden wrote, quote, "Neil's theory of cycle says we are now in a fourth churning. It will hurt, but ultimately give way to better times." That's not a historian talking to grad students. That's a major financial commentator translating the theory for people who make decisions. And later that same year, he tied Howe's framework to other big cyclical thinkers like George Friedman, Peter Turchin, and Ray Dalio, arguing that multiple models were pointing towards severe instability later this decade or early in the 2030s. But wait, there's more. Then he made the jump that really matters. He said people should be planning for their family, their company, and even the nation. So that's where a model stops being descriptive and starts becoming behavioral. Here's where other creators usually screw this up. They find Bannon, they find a finance guy or two, then they start waving their hands and mumbling about collapsed communities and internet culture, like that counts as evidence. But no, it does not. If we're going to say this thing spread, we need to be honest about how it spread. It spread because it gave powerful people a language for a feeling they already had. That the center was failing. That old rules were dying. And once a theory gives that feeling a structure, people cling to it, especially if they already make a living interpreting risk, conflict, or public panic. This theory doesn't belong to one ideology. It tempts every ideology, left, right, center, anti-center, whatever. Different tribes, same temptation. A model that turns chaos into destiny. And hold on, because that's where this gets dark. If you think you're in a normal political era, you try to preserve things. You slow down. You absorb the hit. But if you think you're in the final crisis phase of an old order, well, then you stop acting like a caretaker. You start acting like a survivor, or a strategist, or, if we're being totally honest, maybe a beneficiary. The fourth turning isn't just a theory about history. In practice, it can become a script for behavior, a way to justify escalation, because history is full of people who helped make the disaster bigger while telling themselves they were simply reading the moment correctly. And that leads to the most dangerous possibility in this entire theory. What if it doesn't just predict the collapse? What if it teaches people how to help build it?
Wow. Why have we asked our contractor we found on Angie.com to be our kid's legal guardian? Because he took such good care when redoing our basement that we knew we could trust him to care for our kids, all 8 of them, should something happen to us.
Are you my dad now?
No, sorry, I do basements.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, here's a darker possibility. What if the fourth turning doesn't just predict collapse? What if belief in collapse helps build it? Because once we got through the history and the critics and the receipts, one thing became obvious. This theory did not stay in just a book. And once a theory leaves the page, it can stop being a lens and start becoming a script. Because if enough powerful people start acting like instability is already here, they stop treating stability like something worth protecting. And further, if enough regular people absorb the same mindset, they stop acting like citizens in a stressed system, and instead start acting like survivors in a failing one. So I thought to myself, maybe the cycle doesn't have to be true to become dangerous. It doesn't have to be historically perfect, or even have to predict every crisis cleanly. It just has to be believed by enough people with enough influence and enough people with enough fear. Then the theory can start shaping the very outcome it claims to predict. So for example, people act like collapse is inevitable. Their behavior makes the system weaker. The weakening becomes more visible. And then everybody points at the damage and says, see, it was always coming. Meanwhile, that was never a prophecy. It was just feedback. So essentially, the danger isn't just whether Strauss and Howe were right. The danger is what happens when enough people start living like they were. So here we are. Maybe Strauss and Howe were right. Maybe they weren't. Maybe history really does move in rough recurring seasons. Or maybe humans just keep building the same kind of pressure, then acting shocked when the pipes burst. Either way, the pressure is real. That part is not theoretical. You can feel it. Trust feels weaker. Everything feels louder. And maybe that's true sometimes. But history has a nasty habit. It may not repeat exactly, but human behavior sure as hell does. And that's what lingers for me after all of this. It's the simpler question. What do people do when they start believing the center won't hold? Because systems usually don't fail all at once. People stop trusting them. Then they stop defending them. Then suddenly, one day, everybody acts surprised when the whole thing sounds hollow. So after all is said and done, maybe that's the real value of a theory like this. It forces a hard question, which is, if enough people believe we're entering the season where the old order cracks, are we wise enough to recognize that feeling before we help finish the job? Thank you for watching and for sticking with this story tonight. I appreciate you. I'm Ralph, and this is Divergent Files. If you're still here, you're one of us now. Until next time, stay curious, stay sharp, and remember, no matter what they tell you, the truth is still out there.
Don't you wish everything was more rewarding? With Rakuten, almost everything is. You can earn cash back on those new shoes you've been wanting. You can save on the next trip you book. You can cash in on groceries. Just join, shop your favorite brands, and save. Target, Instacart, Expedia, Macy's, Sephora, CVS, the list is long. Save online, in-store, and at over 22,000 restaurants. And when it's time to redeem those rewards, get your money exactly how you want it. Choose PayPal, check, Bilt points, or cash out with gift cards. Eligible American Express card members can choose to earn membership rewards points instead of cash back. Terms and conditions apply. So go ahead, take a trip. Fill a cart. Order dessert. Rakuten is a world of rewards. Join today for free. Go to Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app. That's Rakuten.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts. Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.